Hello, brothers and sisters. It's March 13th, 14:13 hours, the year 2023, Ward Green. And today we've got another new video on the JW.org website with an update concerning the earthquake in Turkey and a number of other things, including the two new brothers, the newly appointed brothers, who've been appointed to serve on the governing body. And it's Brother Winder and Brother Flegel, I believe. Is that right? Have I got that right? Jeffrey and Gage are the first names, respectively. Flegel. Winder and Flegel, right. Wasn't sure at first how to spell Flegel, but that's probably why I was having trouble being certain of the name. But it is spelled, it could be spelled many different ways, I think. But it's spelled just the way it is. So, anyway, concerning Smenkari, as we continue our study of the Wild Road article, paragraph 10 of chapter 3, his accession in year 15 of the reign of Akhenaten is by Passion 1 reckoning, March 1374 BCE, being the start of year 2 of Akhenaten. That's the Passion 1 reckoning, March. Now, thus, year 15 of Akhenaten would date within March 1361 to March 1360, or 1374 minus 15 plus 2. The difference between year 15 and year 2 being 13, which subtracted from 1374 gives 1361. Or 1360, since it's March to March. So Smenkari began in 1360 at the latest, which would put year 3 vintage in 1358. So 1360, 1359, and 1358 would be the vintages. Though this is only assuming wine is co-regent wine, because, of course, Akhenaten was still alive in his year 15 and lived on beyond that. So we understand. Attested is year 1, wine of the house of Smenkari. That's the only attested vintage. And then years 13 to 17 in ancient Egyptian chronology, page 207, those years of Akhenaten show a title for the vintner, a specific title for the vintner, as given here. In English, it looks like HRJ space B3H, but they're Egyptian letters, they're not English, which continues this title in years 1 and 2 wine records of King Ankikapruri Smenkari. Tut's first recorded date, is year 4, and, as we've discussed previously, it's a lunar day 15, which presents a solid case for his accession before Phamenoth 22nd, or Phamenoth 22, 1357 BCE, and after Koyak 19, 1358, or, in other words, from November 1358 to February 1357. That would be the accession period, during which Tut acceded to the throne at some point in that interval. Since Tut had returned, yes, this is a different topic. Since Tut had returned to Amun worship by year 4, in fact, he left Amarna. And Amarna, they worshipped, at Amarna, they worshipped the sun, Aten. Aten was the god, but The moon god was Amun, and they worshipped him at Thebes and in other places in the previous rulers. For example, the father of Akhenaten, he worshipped Amun. He was Amenhotep III. But Akhenaten broke away from the Amun worship and moved to Amarna and took up worshipping the sun. Now, Tut is the one who broke back and moved back to Thebes by year 4. 4 dates aligned with the moon agree with his accession. So Tut's accession in this period, November 1358 to February 1357, agrees with these 4 dates which are aligned with the moon, which begin with the first of them being year 4. After Tut moved back to Thebes, where they worshipped the moon. So it all fits logically. Now, he being only as certain as Tut, Smenkhkari comes to a finish less than 2 years after the death of Akhenaten. Why? Well, it appears as though we know that Akhenaten had a wine vintage in 1359 in the fall or autumn of that year. Fall 1359 is Akhenaten, and spring of 1357, less than 2 years later, is year 1 of Tut beginning. So it looks like it's clear that Smenkhkari died before 2 years had elapsed after the death of Akhenaten. It is more convincing because of the 2 vintages, or 3, recorded for Smenkhkari, who as sole regent could only be responsible for 1358, because of course Akhenaten was ruling in 1359, and that was his wine vintage. So this implying of course, since Smenkhkari could only... Okay, it is more convincing because of the 2 vintages, or 3, recorded for Smenkhkari, who as sole regent could only be responsible for 1358. This implying co-regent wines. So it's more convincing that Smenkhkari died very soon after the death of Akhenaten, even though he had possibly 3 vintages, because these clearly had to be, with the way that we've got Tutankhamun situated in chronology and the way we have Akhenaten situated, there must have been co-regent wines. So it's very plausible still that Smenkhkari died very soon after Akhenaten's death, without any contradiction here, even though there's possibly 3 vintages. There are, possibly. So little is known about Smenkhkari, however, that the years 1357 and 1356 wines may be of Nefertiti, or maybe the widow of Smenkhkari, who are later subsumed by Tut. So subsumed means that Tut backdated his year 1 to include the reigns of these others within his reign. Because, of course, Smenkhkari was his father, so he might be well justified in doing that. He would be the successor of his father. But we don't know everything. Now, with a dated death of Tut in January, February of 1348, that's another thing. With that being given, autumn 1349 appears to be definitely the last vintage of Tut. That's the prior autumn. Year 9, 1357 minus 1349 is 8 plus 1 is 9, as is attested in Tutankhamun's tomb. So in other words, 8 full years is thereafter becomes year 9, right? So that's why it's 8 years. We add 1 to get the ordinal, or the number that is the ordinal number, 9. For anything after 8 years would be the 9th year, as is attested in Tutankhamun's tomb, because we have a year 9 wine label for Tutankhamun. But this implies also that year 10 found there is Akhenaten's and not Tutankhamun's. There is a year 10 wine label in the tomb of Tutankhamun, but it's not named as to who the king was on that particular wine label. So it may be Akhenaten's or it may be Tutankhamun's. This would seem to, if we believe that Tut died in 1348, January or February, then this implies that that year 10 was Akhenaten's wine. May not appear logical, because it was Tut's tomb. But Hornung made this remark on Tutankhamun in Ancient Egyptian Chronology, page 208. Tut abandoned Amarna, and we say he subsumed the 1358 to 1357 accession of Nefertiti, possibly the same date as the death of Smenkhkari, being the point where Tut chose to demarcate the beginning of his year 1 of rule as pharaoh. The old system of reckoning years from accession resuming after that. So, yeah, so the old system may well have... We're saying that the old system of reckoning years resumed after that. I've got to get some vitamin C. I can feel my throat. I can feel my throat.
Okay.
The problem is, I ate some sugar, and that's, I didn't swallow that well either. That vitamin C just there. I need to get vitamin C. I think I'm going to take another one. I'm not sure if it's slow release. I don't think it is. Just regular. That was better. The first one kind of scratched my throat a little bit, which wasn't good, but I'm coming down with something, it feels like, so got to treat that quickly. Now, I had more to report about what I've been eating too, but it looks like, okay, they could resume the old system and depart from the system of the Passion 1 reckoning of the years after they left Amarna. But it looks like Passion 1 may have been the reckoning method used in Amarna, just as given by the information and research that was obtained through all of the research that was done on Amarna during the research for this article. Became suddenly apparent that the sun was so important to Akhenaten that he may well have had a different way of reckoning the ruling years of the pharaohs. Now I'm not sure exactly how the origin, I'm trying to recollect what the origin was of this. I can't say that I can recall when I first came to this idea, when I became aware of it or was observing something that someone wrote. I'm not sure. But this Passion 1 reckoning may be an original idea, actually. It may be an original idea. But we're willing to say that the old system, after Tut moved back from away from Amarna, back to Thebes, that the old system would logically have resumed. So that they would date everything from the accession date. So Tut's year one would begin in February or March of 1357. It wouldn't begin with any passion date or any date. Of course, it's still March, so it still could be passion. But it wasn't because of passion. It wasn't because of the month of passion, which was the proposed idea for the time at Amarna, was that the reigns of the kings I had assumed, and anybody who reads my articles would have followed this article in particular is the only one, I believe, but it assumes that this passion reckoning that from the first day of summer was something followed or observed at Amarna, and only at Amarna. And the reason why I postulated this theory was because the facts did not fit so well, the way we were trying to do things. It was more of a struggle to fit all the facts within the chronology, so it makes sense that we would approach this new idea with some open-mindedness. And in the footnotes it says, this one footnote, it says, assuming the wine is successive. Where's the footnote? Let's see. It's for the co-regent wines. Assuming the wine is successive, three vintages distinctly occurring after 1359 date from, since 1359 was Akhenaten, we were saying. So the three successive wines after that, the vintages would be 1358 to 1356, and including 1357 as well. But this still could be possible, with Tut revoking the Aten worship in his own year three, moving back to Thebes, since his year one could have been backdated thereafter, assuming Tut was junior king after Smenkari's death, his father Smenkari's death. A neater solution is when year 17 of Akhenaten, year 1 to 3 of his successors, and year 1 of Tut can all be included in the wine vintages for 1359, 1358, and 1357. If that can be possible, because there were possibly co-rulers with Akhenaten because he was sick, according to the article DNA, Wine and Eclipses by Juan Antonio Belmonte, for example. That was the article that suggested the idea that Akhenaten was sick, and that's why, and there were many other ideas there explaining what was happening at the time of this Amarna period. Now Tut year one could have been included there too, because Smenkari, when he died, he could have been succeeded by his son Tutankhamun. The season of winemaking perhaps coincided with deaths for both Akhenaten and his successor, causing sharing of wine vintages, for example, between one king and the next, if they died at the time of winemaking. So that's another possible explanation for why there are so many vintages in such a short space of time. And here we have a picture of the dream stela of Thutmose IV, interestingly. It was not a very clear photograph, drawing, whatever it is. It's a drawing, I suppose. It's a very detailed drawing, if it's a drawing. if it was taken from a photograph, it still contains a lot of detail, whatever it is. But it wasn't very sharp. So it required enhancement. So that's it for that part of today's study. The Wild Road article continues on. We did 310 now, so we're at 311, 312, which will be the last two of this chapter. The last two paragraphs will be 311 and 312. But we're understanding things now, hopefully better, in terms of why all the difficulty in dating Amarna, and also why we were commenting about co-rulership earlier, and why we talked about Tut, you know, subsuming the reign of Nefertiti, and so on. There were so many different things that were mentioned earlier on that we're hopefully explaining in more detail now. Now, for today's Bible study, there is the book of Genesis chapter 13. I'm trying to be careful not to say Psalms. But the other thing is, there's another version of this in the Septuagint. They don't differ very much. So we can read the Masoretic version for this study, I suppose. Following that, if you'd like, though, you can read the Septuagint version of it, perhaps the Netz Bible or whichever version of the Septuagint you can obtain. Following that, Abram went up out of Egypt, he and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him, to the Negev desert. And I'm trying to remember where the Negev is. Let's check the Insight book, maybe. Can we do that from here? Let's look at this. Insight, yeah, this is the Insight book here. It's a reference. I need to move this, or we can't see it. There we go, okay, there we are. So, here's the portion of Insight, the Insight book regarding the Negev. It means south, so it's the desert to the south of Israel, basically. That's what it is. It's south of the mountains of Judah. That's all there really is to say about that right now. Okay, for the purpose of what we're studying. So this is going from Egypt to Israel, or Canaan, as it was then called. It was Canaan that Abraham was promised. It was the promised land in Canaan, but Abram was traveling from Egypt at that time to go back. Let's move this back here. And he was traveling to go back to the land of Canaan, so he had to cross the Negev, which was south of Canaan. And verse 2, and Abram was heavily stocked with herds and silver and gold. Notice this. He was stocked with herds, which, of course, we read about that in chapter 12. It didn't mention silver and gold, if I recall correctly. Pharaoh gave him, in verse 16, sheep and cattle and asses and men servants and maid servants and she-asses and camels. That's 12 and 16 of Genesis. That was before Pharaoh found out that Sarah was not just the sister of Abraham, but she was also his wife. And of course, we learned that she was the sister because we knew that from prior study of the Bible here. Let's see, did we? Right, wait a minute now, hang on. Okay, let's try and click on this. Genesis 20 and 12 is where it says, and besides, she is truly my sister, the daughter of my father, only not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. So that's where that came from. We haven't actually reached that point in the Bible yet in our readings. So, but we don't mention or see any mention, I mean, of gold in Genesis chapter 12. That we don't see that Pharaoh gave Abram gold, but apparently he gave him gold, because as Abram is returning from Egypt to go to the Promised Land, he's stocked with gold and silver in verse 2. And he made his way, so he's rich now. He leaves Egypt a rich man, and he made his way from encampment to encampment out of the Negev and to Bethel, to the place where his tent had been at first between Bethel and Ai. But okay, now I do want to go to the Septuagint. Okay, so Abram was very rich in livestock and in silver and gold, and he journeyed whence he had come into the wilderness, as far as Bethel, to the place where formerly his tent had been, between Bethel and between Haggai. So Haggai is the Septuagint name for Ai, to the place of the altar that he had made there at first. And there, Abram invoked the name of the Lord. And Abram proceeded to call there on the name of Jehovah. So some manuscripts have the name of Jehovah, but the Septuagint doesn't have it, because the Jews, by the time that the Septuagint was made, had already developed a superstition that prevented them from using the divine name. So they said the Lord. And Lot, who was journeying together with Abram, had sheep and cattle and tents. And the land did not have room for them to live together, for their possessions were many, and they could not live together. And strife occurred between the herders of Abram's livestock and between the herders of Lot's livestock. Now at that time the Canaanites and the Perizzites used to inhabit the land. So then, Abram said to Lot, "Let there not be strife between you and me and between your herders and my herders, for we are kindred. See, is not the whole land before you? Separate yourself from me. If you go to the left, I will go to the right, but if you go to the right, I will go to the left." And Lot, lifting up his eyes, saw all the region round about the Jordan, that all was watered. Yeah. Let's put it down lower so we can see it better. All was watered before God had overthrown Sodom and Gomorrah, as we know them. Sodom and Gomorrah, they were well watered, like the orchard of God and like the land of Egypt. until one came to Zagora, which in the Masoretic text is called Zor, until one, as far as, go as Zor. As far as Zor, it says in the Masoretic, but it says until one came to Zagora in the Greek Septuagint. And Lot chose for himself all the region round about the Jordan, and Lot set out from the east, and they separated, each one from his kinsman. So then Abram settled in the land of Canaan, but Lot settled in a city of the regions round about and tented in Sodoma, or Sodom. Now the people who were in Sodoma were wicked and exceedingly sinful before God. And God said to Abram after Lot had separated from him, look up with your eyes. Look from the place where you are now toward the north and the southwest and east and see. Not to the southeast, because Lot was in the southeast. And then he said, for all the land that you see, I will give it to you and to your offspring forever. And I will make your offspring like the sand of the earth. If anyone can count the sand of the earth, your offspring also shall be counted. Rise up, pass through the land, both in the length of it and in the breadth, for I will give it to you. And moving his tent, Abram came and settled by the oak of Mamre, which is in Hebron, and there he built an altar to the Lord. Very similar to the New World Translation reference version, which uses the Masoretic text. Lot chose for himself the whole district of the Jordan. And of course, some weight may have been given to the Septuagint version as well in making this translation, but they're very certainly very similar. In what the content is, Lot chose the whole district of the Jordan, which would be south of the, or at the south end of the Sea of the Arabah, the Salt Sea, which is the Dead Sea as we know it today. So just south of that would be where Lot was dwelling, southeast, the southeast corner of the Promised Land. And it says in the Septuagint, Lot chose all the region round about the Jordan in verse 11. And in the reference version of the New World Translation, it says the whole district of the Jordan. All the region round about the Jordan, yeah, it's very similar. So the promise to Abram that Jehovah would make his offspring like the sand of the earth, in verse 16 it's rendered as the dust particles, like the dust particles of the earth. Same idea in verse 16, the sand or the dust particles. And the oak of Mamre, this Septuagint, is called the big trees of Mamre in verse 18. So they're virtually identical translations. And verse 13 mentions that Lot chose a district that turned out to be the place where some very evil men were dwelling. Which is verse 12 and 13. He dwelt near Sodom, which was the city, one of the cities where, along with Gomorrah, there were some bad and gross sinners against Jehovah dwelling there. So, verse 13, now the people who were in Sodoma were wicked and exceedingly sinful. It's the same meaning in both manuscripts, or according to both of those translations. They're both English versions, of course, of the original, which were written in the case of the Septuagint, it had already been translated into Greek, but in the case of the New World Translation, it was rendered from Hebrew manuscripts, as I understand it, very probably the Masoretic text being one of the major sources for that. For that New World Translation reference version. That's all for today's study of Genesis, little children. I hope you enjoyed that. Oh, I was going to talk about what I've learned about my health. Yes, today I had some very grave difficulty. I had some serious difficulty in eating the peanut butter that I was trying to eat normally, or that I've been trying to choose as a food in place of other things that I was eating before, like dairy and things. I've been eating peanut butter. So today, this morning, when I ate peanut butter, it didn't make me feel very good. I started to feel like I was overdosing on vitamin D again, which is possible because there is vitamin D in peanut butter. And if I was already overdosed on vitamin D, then that's possible. It could be affecting me negatively. So I tried eating some marmalade. That didn't make me feel better at all. So I thought the sugar might be what I needed, you know, to raise my... I was feeling tired or weak, like I was fasting. I felt like I was fasting or something, and I like my blood pressure was low. I thought the sugar might do me good. But what I really needed, actually, I realized later, I needed dairy. I needed to get a latte again. But I also needed to get the saline back into my water, because I've been drinking water without any salt for the past few days. Just wondering whether I've been taking in too much salt. But too little salt will cause your blood pressure to drop. But that wasn't the only problem with the fact that I was getting weaker. It was also true that I felt a little nausea. So that, to me, is a vitamin D poisoning. Or perhaps maybe I just ate the wrong food, but we know peanut butter has a lot of vitamin D2 in it sometimes, so it could have been a vitamin D excess again that was causing the slight nausea. So I was concerned, but now that I've had my salt water, my saline, standard saline, just make yourself a drink of standard saline. You can look it up online, find out what that means. I've explained it in a previous video, but standard saline is basically 1.5 teaspoons of saturated salt water in 10 ounces, or is it 10 ounces? Wait a minute. Yeah. It's 1.5 in 10 ounces or of water, or 1 teaspoon in 200 milliliters. Right. Which is... What's 1 teaspoon in metric? 5 milliliters. It's 5 milliliters of saturated saline solution, which means water that's saturated with salt, hopefully healthy salt, like sea salt or Himalayan salt. Water saturated with salt, 5 milliliters mixed into 200 milliliters of water. That gives you standard saline. That's just like the salt content in human blood. So that's what you get, is standard saline. When you mix that, you drink that. You need that to keep your blood pressure up. That's very important. So that's one thing I learned there too. I believe my blood pressure was dropping because I wasn't consuming enough salt. There's so many things going on, and I'm going to learn even more because of all of these problems I'm having during the time when I'm suffering and recovering from the vitamin D poisoning. Self-inflicted, I might add. But I'm certainly not taking any vitamin D, and I'm going to stop eating the peanut butter now, that's for sure. So I'm stopping the peanut butter for a while, just for a while. And I have a lot of peanut butter in the cupboard now, so I'll be using it later, but it's excellent, but it's just not what I need right now. So I'll be taking a break from that, and therefore I'll be taking a break from marmalade too. I don't need a lot of sugar, but we don't need a lot of sugar, humans. We shouldn't be eating it generally. I'm just doing it because I'm trying to recover from vitamin D excess, and I was trying to prevent the uptake of the vitamin D when I was eating the peanut butter. I thought that eating sugar would prevent the uptake of the vitamin D and thereby, you know, prevent a further complication from excess vitamin D. But every day there are new things, right? More speech bubbles forth. Every day causes speech to bubble forth, and every night brings forth knowledge, as Psalm 19 tells us. So we will continue every day learning more. After every night passes, we will have learned more overnight. That's very fascinating, because we often wake up in the middle of the night with an idea. That's why it's good to keep your notebook, and you should have a notebook, and you should keep it close to your bed, because you'll be able to write things down that you would otherwise forget and lose forever, potentially, but or many of the things you learn at night could be lost forever if you don't have a notebook. So, yeah, my notebook is a very important aspect of the work that I do, because I record every important thing I learn, and every important thing that I can or that I want to keep track of, that I need to remember, I record it in the book. So, and well, Tony Robbins said, if it's worth living, it's worth recording. Which is very encouraging, or very very favorable to the idea of keeping notes in a notebook, not just on scraps of paper, but in a notebook also, because then you can put that book on your bookshelf when you're done recording it, and you'll have all these notebooks from your whole lifetime to look back through and observe what you've been learning, what you had learned and have learned and are learning, and very many benefits come from keeping notes. And as a scientist, of course, observations need to be recorded. Charting the course of your batteries and how many times they're charged and what their cranking capacities are, if they're lead acid batteries and so on. Those are the batteries that I'm generally keeping track of. My lead acid batteries. Technology keeps changing, but lead acid batteries have been around for a long time, and they're a technology that is well established, but it'll probably be around for a good while yet before lithium takes over, because lithium is lighter weight. But still more expensive though. Lithium is than lead acid, but anyway. So there are many things to learn, but also to record in our notebooks. I mean, we need to have a notebook if we want to have any record of what we're doing. So it's a very important aspect, certainly for any scientist, but for anyone else too. I mean, we're all learning spiritual things. We can record those things. We can write down scriptures. I had a good acronym I thought of today. Science the word SING is an acronym, S-I-N-G, and it's an acronym for Science is Not God. And that is a good acronym, I think, because, well, for one thing, singing is not part of science, not by default, anyway. And science is a very unwise thing to worship. We shouldn't worship science, because science is not worthy of worship. It's not even close to being like God. Everlasting life, John 17:3, explains. It comes from taking in knowledge of the only true God. And of the one whom you sent forth, that is Jehovah sent forth, Jesus Christ. We can't just take in knowledge of God and exclude Jesus Christ. In other words, we have to take in knowledge of Jesus Christ. And accepting Christ is part of everlasting life. It's part of gaining everlasting life, is knowing Christ, who is the anointed one of God. He's the chosen one, who was anointed by God to do a task on earth, to redeem faithful mankind. Oh yes, and Brother Schaefer mentioned something I want to mention or comment on in Acts chapter 13. When Paul was visiting Perga, and then he came to Antioch. Okay, he was in Antioch, in Pisidia, and then the presiding officers said to them to share with the people any word of encouragement that they might have. So, this is interesting. Because Paul said, men, Israelites, but he also said, and you others that fear God, hear, listen to me. You that fear God, as well as the Israelites, not just the Jews, but others that fear God also. And then he gave his speech about, which explained how the people were exalted in Egypt, and they were brought out of it with an uplifted arm, and they were put into the wilderness for 40 years, or allowed to be there for 40 years. And then there were nations in Canaan that were overcome by the Israelites, whom they destroyed, and the promised land was obtained. And that was during 450 years, which from 1446, which is about the time of the conquest, which is the time when Caleb stood up in Joshua chapter 14 and commented about how much time had passed. He said 45 years since they spied out the land, which was about 2 years after they left Egypt in 1493, which would be 1491 BCE. 45 years later would be 1446, and at that time Caleb was 85 years old in 1446, whereas he'd been, he said, I was 40 years old in verse 7, Joshua 14 and 7, 40 years old I was when Moses, the servant of Jehovah, sent me out of Kadesh Barnea to spy out the land. Hopefully we'll be talking about Kadesh Barnea later too in our study, as one of the places the Israelites dwelt at during their wilderness wanderings. So it was a major stop for them. It was a place, perhaps you'd say it was in the Negev. It was somewhere south of Israel. And my brothers, some of them, Caleb said, had caused the heart of the people to melt. But he followed Jehovah. And then, 45 years later, he said, they had done this conquest. That this is what the time was at Joshua chapter 14, verse 10. They conquered a good part of this, or the major cities, and the best part of the promised land had been conquered already. But there was still a lot more conquest to do, of course. But still, this was 1446, and if we take that and look at this 450 years in Acts 13 that Paul refers to, we see we're at verse 18 and verse 20. He says all these things occurred during about 450 years. Now some people, like the King James translation, it says that the 450 years were the time of the judges, but we know that that would be wrong. It was more like about 350 years. But there are many commentators who've accounted it as a longer portion of time than 350 years, because they don't have any overlap between the judging on the east of the Jordan and the judging on the west, which is explained in the genealogy that we have. So in our chronology, it doesn't make any sense to say 450 years was the time of the judges, because our chronology is more accurate than that. But the 450 years, therefore, must go backwards from... And in most of the translations that you do find, that we find, we all see that the 450 years is most commonly and almost unanimously applied to the time before the conquest in Canaan. So from 1446 back 450 years, 446 is about 450, so say 450 plus 450. Or say 1450 plus 450 would be 900 plus 1,000, or, you know, 450 and 450 is 900, and 1,000 plus 900 is 1,900. That would mean that the Jews were exalted in Egypt in about the year 1900, which is 450 years earlier than the conquest in Canaan. And that's perfectly consistent with the genealogy, which says that Joseph began to be a free agent or a citizen of Egypt in 1923, when he was appointed by Pharaoh to be the second ruler over all of Egypt. After Pharaoh, he was second in command. And Jacob came into Egypt in 1914 BCE in the genealogy, which is also very close to 1900. It's even closer. So this 450-year period is just about precisely fulfilled here by the genealogy, as well as the many other things that the genealogy does actually explain very satisfactorily and very pleasingly to the soul. And fortunately, and by the blessing of Jehovah only, do any of these things come about. None of what we have comes from ourselves. It always comes from Jehovah. Always. We don't issue anything of ourselves. We can't, because even our food comes from somewhere. How can we issue anything if we're not eating any food? So everything we have that we issue forth has to come from Jehovah. And he does give us free will. That's a very great blessing that we do have. But and that was occurring to me too recently that for somebody to be born and raised only knowing the life of a minister, you know, of a minister or a person who is part of an organization that is centered on and focused on Bible ministry, that person has a very different viewpoint than somebody who has been exposed to the world and has, I mean, we're all exposed to the world, I suppose, in one way or another. But I mean, the way I was raised, okay, it was different. I was taught that we had freedom, that we weren't just pointed in the direction of one career opportunity or one goal or one. We didn't have that set before us in that way. We were given the opportunity to choose anything, that you could choose anything you want, do anything you want. And it was set before us without, at least in my family, without any attempt to predetermine what we would choose. We weren't encouraged in one path, other than, obviously, everybody does, whether consciously or subconsciously, attempt to influence everyone else to choose some path or other, I suppose. So perhaps, I mean, it's difficult to hide it. Perhaps my father was, or my biological father and my guardian was seeking to direct me into a life of a career that was similar to his in physics or in nuclear technology. But really, and I think he did have that hope, but that was not, I mean, there was no real encouragement given. There was no attempt to, what's the word? Well, to cultivate that idea or to nurture. Yeah, there was no attempt to nurture this career path or anything like that. So it would just disintegrate on its own if in my case I simply chose or came across a different career path idea that would please me more, then I would be able to just, you know, change course and pursue a different career path. So, and that's essentially, I suppose, it's what I did to some extent, but not really. But yes, once I chose, well, I mean, when I left school to go to California hitchhiking, I had not yet graduated with my bachelor degree, so I was changing course then, in a sense. But then when I came back and finished my undergraduate degree and then got my master's degree in experimental physics, that gave me the possibility that I might be going into the same career path that my dad had chosen. But I didn't do that, at least not in the final analysis. I ended up choosing music and being a songwriter for quite a few years under the support or with the support of my wife financially, so that I didn't need to do it as my primary or as any source of income. But that took place for a while, and then I encountered the Witnesses of Jehovah for the first time in my life shortly after beginning that course of music. which was really begun, my musical path was begun in earnest in 1987 when I acquired the MS-16 one-inch tape recorder, along with the MS-520, not MS-520, M-520, the M-520 Tascam mixing board. It was the Tascam MS-16 was the tape recorder. So, both of which I still have, but nowadays it's a digital world, and the tape machine is not, I mean, while it would still function, it would require maintenance to get it working, and it would require tape which would be, you know, have to be stored and administered, you know, according to an edit, whatever editing had to be done would have to be done in that medium rather than digitally. So it makes more sense to perhaps anyway change to digital as a medium at this point. But I haven't just been pursuing music. I've been pursuing my engineering as a sort of a sideline, not for any wages or any financial gain or return, but just engineering and designing things for my own use. I've been practicing my engineering all these years also, but you know, it's hard to say really what my job has been, and that's always been a difficult question. If somebody asked me that, I could tell them what I've been doing, but even that, I wasn't keeping track of everything, or I didn't have much time to stop and think what I'd been doing all these years, what all the things were that I've been doing. Well, I built a recording studio, I designed and built a console, you know, I built another roll-around unit to house the tape machine, you know, and I had to design the system of devices that would be part of the studio. All these things were done over those years from the time we moved here, essentially, but especially more particularly from 1987. And then, well, the tape machine stopped being used sometime in, I'm trying to think, did I use it as late as the year 2010, or was it just around the year 2000? Or shortly thereafter when I stopped using it. Anyway, it was essentially done. The use of the tape machine was essentially over by about the early 1990s, as far as using it in any large capacity or at any decent or significant frequency of use. I mean, in terms of any daily type of use or any, you know, weekly or monthly use, it was not really used after about the year 2000, I think, and I probably had a few resurgences after that, but the machine was essentially broken sometime around 2010, I think, or 2013, whatever date it was. It was sometime in the 2000s, I think, but or 2010s, but that the machine essentially, I don't think it was the late 1990s, but yeah, it was anyway. Sometime after the early 1990s, the machine was essentially not as useful. So, and I realized later, of course, that the problem was the tapes, not the machine. So that the machine might be essentially still functional, but the tapes were not functional. That's true, yeah. But to buy one of these analog tapes, it would be, nowadays it's more, but back then it was probably at least $100, I believe, but now it's much more than that, I would assume. I believe it's got to be more than that, but it's probably closer to $200 or more in Canadian dollars to buy a one-inch analog tape that I could use. But the machine itself Yeah, the machine itself might actually be fully functional. It might. That's true. So I might be able to do analog recording. That's exciting. It's very much preferable in some ways to do analog recording, because analog recordings have this ability of the tape to survive, or what's the word? They even benefit from saturation, from sending in more signal than the tape can handle, or than the tape is capable of recording in terms of dynamics. If you've got more dynamics than the tape can actually hold, if you supersaturate, it doesn't do any harm to the recorded signal. In fact, it can sound to many people's ears very desirable in terms of an audio sound. And digital is completely different in that way, because when you reach a certain threshold, you don't get saturation, you get clipping, which chops off the top of the audio wave, and that makes a very harsh sound to human ears. It's not a pleasant sound, so we have to avoid all clipping in digital recording. So it's a completely different thing from analog recording. But I don't know if I'll use analog recording. I think I want to learn to do digital recording, but that means always allowing a great amount of safety in the recording levels, especially if the singer is capable of producing a high volume in their voice, and that could also cause clipping. Then there are choices that can be made with regard to compression, or putting a limiter on the signal, either in the preamp or after the preamp part of the microphone signal chain, somehow limiting what's being recorded before it gets to the digital what do you call that? The digital bus, yeah. Before it gets to the place where the distortion could occur, you can limit the signal. But that limiting will alter and distort in its own way. You will lose dynamics by doing that. It's not the most desirable thing to do, to alter your soft and quiet levels of your voice in order to compress it or limit the maximum. It's not natural, so it's not as desirable as recording at perhaps a safe margin of safety, you know, a safe margin of under loudness. And that, however, introduces more noise if you go quieter, and only the loudest parts of the recording will then be completely free of noise, so to speak, you know, relative to the signal being put in. So it just complicates matters having a digital recording system, you know, rather than analog. Analog, you could just, you know, not worry about what the maximum level is going to be, provided you had a good tape recorder. That's the thing. For example, the MS-16 could handle quite a high level of overload, or whatever you want to call it, over voltage. It could handle it. Yeah, over voltage. But anyway, those are things of the past now, because we're in a digital world, and I don't know if we're ever going to get back to analog, although there often is a resurgence of some of the older technologies. Vinyl being another one that's, of course, experiencing a resurgence after the compact disc revolution occurred. But this is Ward Green. It is Monday, March 13th, 2023. It's 15:23 hours. God bless you. People don't understand how important it is to accept that there is a savior of the world. They don't understand that. Perhaps they lack humility and they can't accept it. Because of that reason, I think that's the major reason for many of us why we can't accept a Messiah or a savior. But the more you learn about Jesus, I think it's possible to see how we can be humble and we can subject ourselves to Christ, who is a mediator between God and us as men and women, of course, and children and everybody. But of course, children have their parents as an additional mediator. But we have, and I hope all the brothers now in Turkey are going to recover from this grievous earthquake that they had, which of course did cost some people their lives in this system of things, which is very always tragic, of course. It's such a traumatic experience for anyone who's lost a loved one. So we sympathize with that, and praise Jehovah. I love you all, and have a great day. Bye for now.